Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right, good afternoon, folks. Happy Tuesday. Welcome back. And yeah, there's a lot of people waiting with bated breath to see just how far down the Banana Republic road the once free United States has already gotten. I do think, at least as we set out to look at Ezekiel chapter 31 here, and to continue to look at the judgments upon these various ancient lands and how they parallel, if not literally rhyme, with the things we're seeing today. It's important to remember that so much of the paganism then is paganism now, and we'll go through some of those parallels as we continue again. But last week we got into chapter 31, and it has to do with Egypt. As we started out here, the first kind of extensive metaphor that's developed in about the first 9 verses of the chapter have to do with this tree, which is being watered and has fine branches, and it gets high, and it basically gets a little bit mighty too, and a lot that's going on there. So with that, like I said, we got a little ways in there. Let's go first to MP and let him pick it up in those first few verses and take us to where he'd like. Howdy, Mark.
All right, howdy. How y'all doing?
Good.
And all you people out there in radio land. All right, so... Yeah, I got through verses 1 and 2 for sure last week. So let me recap just the end of this chat, verse 2 here. Azan's comment on it is that the prophet challenges Pharaoh, asking him, "To whom do you think you compare in your greatness?" In other words, in aggrandizing yourself before God, according to Rashi, for the empire of Assyria achieved even greater heights than Egypt, yet God put Assyria down. If so, why should Pharaoh think he was any better and could survive? Okay, from the perspective of today's world of mega superpowers, we may tend to look back on ancient Assyria, which had no cars, airplanes, computers, satellites, or any other marvels of modern technology, as little more than a short-lived, puny forerunner of later empires. We should therefore bear in mind that in this time, in its time, Sennacherib's empire comprised the greater part of the known world, extending from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean across the entire Middle East, deep into Central Asia, while its capital of Nineveh was legendary in its grandeur and its sophistication. Now, and by the way, I've read a series of books called The Lost Tribes of Israel Found by Stephen M. Collins, one of the best series of books I've ever read about Israel and where it has gone since it was dispersed. Okay? And it's an incredible series of books. Anyway, verse 3 speaks of the Assyrian metaphorically resembling a cedar of Lebanon with fair branches. It calls them fair branches. The Hebrew root for fair is yafa, and it means to project beauty or incite the senses. This evokes sensual pleasure. A shadowing shroud is from the Hebrew 6751 salal, and it means to sink into depths and prevent entry of outside stimuli. So the surrounding shroud is speaking of a secret place in which to do things that might be frowned upon by the more upright in character. Okay, so self-aggrandizement in a secret or private place where no one else can see, except Yah, of course. High stature is from the Hebrew 1361 gabah, which means to rise high through the concentration of elements, and kum, which means to rise or establish. These two words that reinforce and support each other, and taken with what came before, it would seem that this individual or group think that they are literally all that and a bag of chips. I cannot help but think that this guy has a much higher opinion of his own value than he ought. His top, it's his own mind anyway, is from the Hebrew 6785, tamar, which means to cover, as a well-developed treetop, okay, to cover, like a large tree. And the HR 5687, avat, which means to tie or to entwine in order to strengthen. What this actually sounds like to me is a lot of full of themselves without reason or merit guys, like the present administration, and this, by the way, was written in March of 2023 and the president administration in D.C., okay, the Biden administration is full of a bunch of guys that think of themselves as something special when, in fact, they're a bunch of nothings. Anyway, verse 4, Zamra has this. The prophet allegorically depicts Assyria as a great cedar. The waters make it great. The deep set it up on high, in verse 4. Targum renders, it abounded with nations. It was mighty through its allies. It subjected the kingdoms under its rule and put its government over all the countries of the world. Remember that we are speaking of Paro, who is likened to the Assyrian and is about to be defeated handily and thoroughly by Nebuchadnezzar. And Assyria is another rising star, as it were, that will follow Babylon as the conquering empire. Egypt, as a regional power, is on its way out, never to achieve its former greatness, and it never has. In the region, it is a force to be considered, but Israel could handily defeat Egypt in a one-on-one, toe-to-toe fight. In fact, it would probably take all the regional powers surrounding Israel to really give it a viable fight. But the time we are discussing here today, Egypt was an also-ran. By this time, it was an also-ran and on its way to mediocrity. Okay, now verses 5 and 6, I'll cover those and then I'll pass it on. Zeke is speaking of the Assyrian, whom I think was Sennacherib, though it may have been his father Sargon II. The time is late 700s BCE. TSK has this comment on verse 5. They say that's a treasury of scripture knowledge. It's in my Bible program. The Assyrian king to whom Paro is compared, from his great power, extensive dominion, and the protection that he afforded, resembled the spreading branches, the thick shade, and high stature of a flourishing cedar on Mount Lebanon. The fruitful lands of Assyria, the immense revenues that he drew from vast multitudes of his extensive territories, his lucrative commerce by the river Tigris, with the countries on the Indian Ocean, and all the various sources of his wealth and prosperity resembled the rivers and streams which caused the trees. Were exalted above all the kingdoms of the earth. That last line in verse 5 says in the KJV, when he shot forth. But the ending is third person only, not he, but it, speaking of the Assyrian army more than any single human. Of course, the army was probably all male, so, you know, it wouldn't fit today. Anyway, verse 6 continues the allegory of the Assyrian as the towering tree in which the birds of the air are building nests in the living and living in its boughs. Those birds were probably the vassal kings under Sennacherib's control and their deputies. The TSK gives a reference from earlier in Ezekiel that may give some support to this idea. From Yechezkel chapter 17, verses 12 to 24, and this is going to be kind of lengthy, so bear with me. Say now to the rebellious house, know ye not what these things mean? Tell them, behold, the king of Babylon has come to Jerusalem, and hath taken the king thereof, and the princes thereof, and led them with him to Babylon, and hath taken the king's seed, and made a covenant with him, and hath taken an oath of him. He hath also taken the mighty of the land, that the kingdom might be base, that it might not lift itself up, that by keeping of this his covenant, it might stand. But he rebelled against him in sending his ambassadors to Egypt, that they might give him horses and much people. Shall he prosper? Shall he escape that doeth such things? Or shall he break the covenant and be delivered? I live, saith Adonaiah. Surely in the place of king of the king dwelleth that made him king, whose oath he despised and whose covenant he brake. With him in the midst of Babylon he shall die. Neither shall Paro with his mighty army and great company make for him in the war by casting up mounts and building forts to cut off many persons. Seeing he despised the oath by breaking the covenant when, lo, he had given his hand and hath done all these things, he shall not escape. Therefore, thus saith Adonaiah, I live, surely mine oath that he hath despised and my covenant that he hath broken, even it will I recompense upon his own head. And I will spread my net upon him, and he shall be taken in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon, and will plead with him there for his trespasses that he hath trespassed against me. And all his fugitives, with all his bands, shall fall by the sword, and they that remain shall be scattered toward the winds. And ye also shall know that I, Yah, have spoken. Thus saith Adonai Yah. I will also take of the highest branch of the high cedar and will set it. I will crop it off from the top of his young twigs, a tender one, and will plant upon a high mountain and eminent. In the mountain of the height of Israel will I plant it, and it shall bring forth boughs and bear fruit and be a goodly cedar. And under it shall dwell all fowl of every wing. In the shadow of the branches thereof shall they dwell, and all the trees of the field shall know that I, Yah, have brought down the high tree. I have exalted the low tree, have dried up the green tree. I have made the dry tree to flourish. I, Yah, have spoken and done it. The mountain, the height of Israel, has to be the Temple Mount, in my opinion. The low tree that Yah exalted in this passage anyway is Assyria. I'm going to stop there and let you guys have at me.
All right. Ken, how about you? You got anything you want to add or comment or correct?
3 verse 6.
Well, no, not really. I like to hear different perspectives, and I know Mark is looking in a number of places for such perspectives, so I can always appreciate
that. Absolutely.
And I think we all Absolutely. Should appreciate that.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, I see a metaphor here that's interesting. It obviously openly applies to Pharaoh and to Egypt. And as I've suggested already, it certainly applies to all kinds of things that get kind of high and mighty and exalt themselves above all the other trees of the field and you name it. And, you know, it's hard to miss those parallels. Okay. Ken, well, then why don't you go ahead and take us further wherever you'd like.
Yeah, and I think everybody may have remembered when I was also speaking of the garden last week and how I saw the trees in the garden as entities, not only the Messiah and Hashatan himself, Satan, but also the angels. The angels could have been other trees that were in the garden. I really don't believe there were other fleshly beings at that time, considering when they were divorced from the garden, you know, kicked out. At that time, it said clearly that it was Adam and Hawa that were kicked out of the garden. So I would think it's just these two that were still there at that time. It's kind of hard to depict or say exactly how much time it transpired, you know, from the days of creation to this time when they had sinned and they were then taken out of the garden. But that was just my perspective on it. And I know not everybody may see it that way, but I was kind of correlating that to the Assyrian, you know, being a cedar tree. And, because, you know, Yah does, depict this a lot, throughout scripture, even in the Brit Hadashah or New Testament, when, if we recall, Messiah had, healed a blind man. And what was the first thing from his mouth when he was asked, "What do you see?" And he said, "I see trees as men." And yeah. I believe that was kind of a revelation for all of us, even, yeah. I mean, at least in that day. You know, to consider that Yah does use that metaphoric perspective, you know. Well, was there something you want to add there, MP?
Yeah, I see trees as men walking. That's what was, I mean, the trees were walking as like they were wading through the dirt. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Pretty wild, what is it that, that Tolkien analogy when the trees get up and walk, and I forget the all the Tolkien fans can certainly remember the name of the battle, but there you go.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the entire forest came and just ate all them orcs. It was great.
Okay. That's right. That was a pretty cool movie.
Well, like I said, I tend to focus on...
Hey, if you...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I really didn't want to repeat too much, so if we could read on through at least verse 11, I could comment a little bit more.
Okay, we'll do that. And like I said, I tend to think that some of the parallels should be obvious. And yes, we have ancient societies that were world powers that dominated the world at one point. And it's important to remember that there is a particularly high and mighty world power, the Big Tree today, that did dominate the world at one point, and we're rapidly seeing that come to a close, exactly as it was and did for all these other powers that exalted themselves and were brought low. So it's impossible, I think, at least, not to recognize and take note of all of that. So let's go on, because it begins this way in verse 10. "Therefore, thus says Yahuwah Elohecha, because you have increased in height, and it set its top among the thick boughs, and its heart was lifted up in its height." Well, you can almost look at what's happening in the District of Criminal Swamp today and say, huh, gee, what is it? The more things change, the more they stay the same. There's French for that, too. Anyway, "therefore," he says, "I will deliver it into the hand of the mighty one of the nations, and he shall surely deal with it. I've drawn it out for its wickedness." And, as I read this, guys, my only comment is it just leaps right off the page at you. "And aliens," huh? You mean the kind that are swarming across the southern border? "And aliens, the most terrible of the nations, have cut it down and left its branches, Its branches have fallen on the mountains and in all the valleys. Its boughs lie broken by all the rivers of the land, and all the peoples of the earth have gone from under its shadow and left it." Okay, I read that and I say, hey, you know, what else is there to add? But go ahead, let's go to you, Ken.
So as a nation, this is speaking to Assyria, as a nation, it appears that they were a prideful bunch. I mean, in reading, especially verse 10, lifting up their height, shooting up their top. Over their thick bowels. I guess that's pronounced bowels. "And his heart is lifted up in his height." So, you know, really, again, I think is being more metaphoric here in comparing the man or a man or even a nation as a tree, and he is lifting himself up. So it's definitely a pride issue. Which is one characteristic that Yah strongly dislikes. And when considering his commandments and his statutes, we find that pride is right up there, I think, with like things like hate and selfishness. And we see that such pride Yah plainly details here in verse 10 is referred to in verse 11, which is wickedness or iniquity. Sorry, where was that? Yeah, that was the Strong's number 7562, which is Reshah. The wrong, the iniquity, wickedness. These are some of the Strong's, renderings for that Hebrew word. And that word driven out, driven him out. At Strong's number 1644, which is Garash. Because of such wickedness, Yah drives out man from the land, as Yah has been doing from the beginning. And I'm, when I say beginning, I'm referring all the way back to Bereshit or Genesis 3 verse 24, when Adam and Hawa were driven out of the garden. Again, it's the word Garash. And which matches the idea of divorce.
Well, it's the same word that's used for divorce, eh? Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's the same word that is used for the process when it's completed. It's not used very often in that context, but when it's used, that is the word for a divorce, eh, as has that same root.
Correct. And the idea there, of course, is usually if, for example, the wife is in sin, the man would literally drive the woman out of the house because he must separate or take away the sin or the wickedness.
Well,
okay. We must always be set apart.
Let's pause there for a second. Just to make this clear, there are two words that are used. The more common one is shalach. The root word there is the shin lamed chet. And it's the same word that was used to exile or drive Adam and Eve out of the garden, to shalach. It's the same word that is used when a tree sends out a branch, or when people are sent into exile and were scattered through all the nations of the world. It is the same word used in Deuteronomy chapter 24, when a man sends out a wife. And the process, and that's the thing that I'll make sure we understand the distinction. The process is he shalachs the wife first, then she has gone out of the house. If she is able to get remarried, he must then give her a sefer keratuta, that certificate of divorce, put it in her hand, and then when she is shalached, and that's a horrible Englishization of the Hebrew, but anyway, once that happens and the process is complete, now she can go be another man's wife. So a lot of the prohibitions, forbidding to marry, as Paul puts it, are bogus. All we got to do is read Deuteronomy, the first three verses of chapter 24. But then there is a place where it talks about vows in Numbers chapter 30, and that's a word where we see the word garash used. In other words, a woman to whom this has been done, and she now no longer has a living husband, she has been sent away and given the certificate, is a garasha, if you will, and she is now a divorcee, we might say. But I'm always careful otherwise to make sure we don't confuse those two words as if to send away and to divorce are the same. They're not. And Deuteronomy 24 makes it real clear there is a difference. So, by the way, does the Mashiach in Matthew 5 and other places. Anyway, go ahead. So I just want to make sure whenever we get to that those words appear, I got to make sure that we're clear they're not the same. They're not synonyms.
Right, they're not synonyms, but again, the ideas are similar in terms of separation. You know, there's separation of good from evil, and that's just simply the way of Yah. You know, he doesn't want to mix the good and the bad. He wants people to discern and to then separate, and so such separation of man from the land is normally achieved by either death or captivity. And here, both will occur with the Mitzvites. there will be such a great slaughtering. It's terrible. And it's definitely detailed here and in other chapters. I think we'll see it again even more so in next chapter as well. But also some will be brought into captivity.
All right, and we are at the break, so we'll
stop there
after this.
And I'm breathing, and I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord will turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy-to-do. Yeshua, double B and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new. Shalom, Diddy,
Osher too. Alright, we are back, folks, and looks like, Ken had basically finished what he wanted to say when the music came up, so that means let me just turn it over to MP and let him pick it up somewhere in there and work his way up to where we are.
All right. I'm going to work my way up through verse 11 so that we can get Ken on some new info. So in verses – well, wait a minute. Let me do this. Rashi hints why God – granted Assyria such power, the power that he had granted them. He says this, for what reason did Assyria attain greatness? Because Asher, the founder of Nineveh, refrained from collaborating in the plan of those in the generation of the dispersal, that is the Tower of Babel. As it says, Asher left the land in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 11, when all the people in the world joined together in one network to rebel against God. Okay? Furthermore, Asher listened to the voice of the prophet Jonah and repented from the robbery in their hands. Okay? So he turned away from them, and that's why Asher got to be Assyria. It's a pretty big nation. So, in verse 7 and 8, the past tense signifies to me Egypt, which has been great, but is no longer. And its dominant place in the region is being overtaken by Assyria in our passage. As I said above, Egypt was a great power, but it isn't at the time we're studying, nor has it taken back its former station. Much like we see in the United States of America presently, America, like Egypt, could return to its former greatness by submitting to Yah. But the chances of that are exactly two, slim and none. While there were many faithful to Yah in America, it is anything but a majority or even a large minority. America needs a real revival of godliness in Yah, or in Yah, to recover its former greatness. May it be soon, and may it be in our day. Keep praying for godly leadership in government. There are some, but they are few. Now, back to our actual subject. In verse 8, the cedars of Eden couldn't have hidden the greatness of Egypt in its time, any more than America's greatness could be hidden. But that isn't how it was for Egypt in our passage, nor is it for America today. As Egypt was in decline then, so is America now. These cedar trees can be likened to the beauty of Lucifer in the Garden of Elohim before his fall. And in Ezekiel chapter 28 and verses 12 through 19, we see that. He says, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus, and say unto him, Thus saith Yah Elohim, Adonai Yah, thou sealest up the sun, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of Elohim. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. Now you know who we're talking about now. This is Hasatan. And I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of Elohim. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created till iniquity was found in thee. by the multitude of thy merchandise, they have filled the midst of thee with violence, and thou hast sinned. Therefore I will cast thee as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy thee, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Thine heart was lifted up because of thy beauty. Thou hast corrupted thy wisdom by reason of thy brightness. I will cast thee to the ground. I will lay thee before kings, that they may behold thee. Thou hast defiled my sanctuaries by the multitude of thine iniquities, by the iniquity of thy traffic. Therefore will I bring forth a fire from the midst of thee. It shall devour thee, and I will bring thee to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold thee. All they that know thee among the people shall be astonished at thee. Thou shalt be a terror, and never shalt thou be any more. Again, that's Ezekiel 28, 12 through 19. Now, can you see that as a parallel to what's going on with the United States of America right now? Okay, because I can. That's all true, the United States of America today. It was founded on biblical principles with mostly godly men in charge, and it remained so for longer than any nation in history except Israel, Yehuda itself, which had many godly kings, but they became fewer and further between as time progressed, or rather regressed, which is more correct, and the nation aged. The last truly godly king of Yehuda was Yoshiahu in his youth. But even he regressed when he aged, and especially after his mentor, the Kohen Gadol, Hilkiyahu, died. Is this not like what we are seeing in America today? I can see it. If America doesn't have a revival, it will perish like the other great nations that we see in Scripture and in history, and it will come quickly. It will come very, very quickly. It will happen like overnight.
You keep using the future tense.
That's what I got through verse 8.
I started to say you keep using the future tense, MP, as if it hadn't already happened and very quickly. So that's the only thing I would take issue with before you ask.
Well, you're absolutely correct. In the vast majority of the nation, you are absolutely correct. It has gone thoroughly wicked. But there is still, as you can see just in this radio station, there is still a remnant.
Sure. Well, there was
can
a remnant.
Bring things back
there
if
was
we
a
get
remnant
it to get our own stuff together.
Yeah, there was a remnant.
Okay, now.
Okay, there was a remnant.
Remember.
Never mind.
Well, yeah.
No, we got the major lag today. We're not hearing each other. There was a remnant even in the time of Elijah, Eliyahu, that he wasn't even aware of. And that's the issue. So, we're a lot bigger. Right. The United States is a lot bigger than Israel was then population-wise. You would hope that there would be at least more than 7,000 today. But although I look around and sometimes doubt it. Certainly that's probably not true there in the swamp, as Ken might be able to attest.
Yeah. I guess I do swim amongst the swamp creatures almost on a daily basis. But hey, we all have to have jobs,
okay.
I guess.
If you guys will give me another 2 minutes, I'll catch up to Ken. Okay?
Sure.
Azamra has this for verses. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. No, I gotta hit a 9 yet. Remember that we are still likening everything to the Assyrian in verse 3. So in verse 9, Yah says that he has made him, the Assyrian, like the cedars, the fir and chestnut trees of verse 8. None of the trees in the garden were like the Assyrian for beauty. Okay, the Hebrew 32:02 Yaffa means to excite the senses. And that's literally what it says about the Assyrian. As I said before, I think this Assyrian, who is likened to a tree in the garden of Elohim with Adam and Chava, is Sennacherib. We know there were a lot of trees in the garden. But we were introduced to only one of them, the tree of life in the midst of the garden. So I liken Sennacherib to the tree in the midst of the garden, which was envied by all the other trees. Okay, and that's my own personal opinion, and I could be wrong, but I seriously doubt it. Now, Zamra has this on verses 10 and 11. In other words, Assyria retained a certain moral level in virtue of which it attained greatness. Nevertheless, Assyria fell into a sin of pride and was therefore cast down. You have lifted yourself up in height, and his heart is lifted up in his height. I have therefore delivered him into the hand of the mighty one of the nations. That's in verses 10 and 11. Sennacherib had arrogantly supposed that after his other successes over idolatrous nations, that he would be able to conquer God's city of Jerusalem. But his armies were miraculously wiped out overnight. Assyria still maintained its empire for more than a century after Sennacherib's defeat, but was finally overthrown by the mighty one of the nations, in other words, Nebuchadnezzar, who had conquered Nineveh in the first year of his reign, 27 years before his coming conquest of Egypt. Now, Sennacherib's haughtiness is not going over well with Yah in verses 10 and 11, where Adonai Yah said, "You have lifted yourself up, Gabah, haughty, high, and shot yourself up, Matan, to give over, among the thick boughs, and lifted up high your own heart." Sennacherib has gotten to the place where Yah is going to delight in knocking him down a few hundred steps by paying him fairly for the evil that he's committed against every nation he has dominated through his cruelty. And he will do so through Nebuchadnezzar, who subverted the Assyrian Empire. Here's what it says in Jeremiah 25:9. "Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, saith Yah, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and will utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and an hissing, and perpetual desolations." That's what I got through verse 11.
All right.
So move on, Ken.
Yeah, I think we can read on a little bit. Ready, MC?
I am ready. Let's continue from about verse 13 or so then. He's talking about the tree and the aliens and the fact that it's going to be cut down. Its boughs will lie broken by all the rivers of the land, and the peoples have gone away and they've left it. "On its ruin," it continues, "will remain all the birds of the heavens, and all the beasts of the field will come to its branches, so that no trees by the water may ever again exalt themselves for their height, nor set their tops among the thick boughs, that no tree which drinks water may ever be high enough to reach up to them. For they have all been delivered to death and to the depths of the earth among the children of men who go down into the pit." I want to pause there, or we want to go on? I'll continue. Since
How about just one more verse?
All right. Yeah. And I'm going to preface this then with a word here, and that is that we're going to see, at least in this English translation, the New King James Version that I'm looking at, several references to hell. And as most folks will know, hell is not exactly, at least the Catholic version, a concept that is really appropriate in Scripture. The word there is Sheol, and Sheol actually has a connotation of death or the grave, particularly yes. the grave. So when it says hell in the English, I'm going to put the word in there in the Hebrew, Sheol, so that it's clear. "Thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, in the day when it went down to Sheol, I caused mourning. I covered the deep because of it. I restrained its rivers, and the great waters were held back. I caused Lebanon to mourn for it, and all the trees of the field wilted because of it." And I'll read one more to get to a nice stopping place. "I made the nations Goyim shake at the sound of its fall when I cast it down to Sheol together with those who descend into the pit. And all the trees of Eden, the choice and the best of Lebanon, all the drink water, were comforted in the depths of the earth." And let's pause there. Okay, who wants it first? Well, we'll go to you, Ken. Ken?
Oh, I'm sorry. I turned my mic off. There it is. I got it now. sorry about that. I take these verses of 12 through 14 as metaphoric detail of dead bodies laying all throughout the land, killed by the sword. Now, Nebuchadnezzar's great and terrible army of nations defeated and brought to the grave many beings as torn down trees, and others scattered throughout the earth in captivity. So this great event we see in, where did I see that? I'm trying to remember where I saw it, where this great event was heard of and witnessed by many throughout the nations. Yeah, at the end of 14. That goes, it says the nether parts of the earth, lower parts could also be rendered as, and there's all this talk too about like what MC was, pointing out about, the grave, brought down, going down to the pit. I believe that's kind of a misconception of Christianity in terms of, what Sheol really means. Now, for me, I like to look at, what the book of Enoch says, which is where, all the dead are taken to a certain level up there in the heavens. And this level has like two sides. One side, has a little bit of light and some trickling water, which is where those in Messiah would rest. You know, the souls would rest. And then on the other side, it's very dark and cold. And this is where you would see the folks that would be a part of the second resurrection. I don't know if some of y'all out there might remember, I think it's in Revelation, it speaks about the two different, resurrections, the first and the second. Absolutely. And Messiah actually said that you definitely want to be a part of the first resurrection. And that's because resurrection are those that are in Messiah. Go ahead, MC.
I said, don't hang around. Don't hang around there in Sheol any longer than you have to.
And so those on the that were a part of, they're a part of the second resurrection. See, they would be remaining there in the grave for another 1,000 years. See, during the Shabbat millennium, which is the beginning and towards the end of the second or seventh day or seventh millennium. Okay, and that's how I render what's being written there. And it very much ties in with what Ezekiel speaks about. Not to mention Mashiach, he also details the dead and other places in scripture speak about, you know, the dead know nothing, and that they sleep. You know, Messiah said, like he said about Lazarus, he's sleeping, you know, that's all, he's sleeping. he can, you know, I will awaken him. And that's what happens to all of those, both in the first and second resurrections, are this great awakening, you know. And of course, the first resurrection, that awakening, there's also a lot of good scripture in places like, I think, 1 Corinthians 15 and that's 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and some others that speak about how that is a time in which those who are still alive will be lifted up into the air to meet also those from the grave. And Messiah coming down with his, army of angels, you know, all to meet in the air, it says. And then I believe at that point we're actually brought down to the earth where he rules and reigns. Now I believe he steps his foot down on the earth first before we all come down with him, because if you look at Zechariah chapter 14, you see a little bit of that where, you know, he steps foot on the earth and then he begins to pretty much slaughter. There's blood, etc. Where the some of the wicked, I guess, are slain or are still alive. So anyway, that's just a I'm grasping at things that are related here. I'm trying to thematically connect a few things together, which might be a little too much, but I'll go ahead and stop there, just through verse 14. And did you want to speak on, up to verse 14, MP?
Yeah, I can do that. I wanted to mention the second resurrection. There's only one verse in Scripture where the two words are in the same verse, and that is Revelation chapter 20 and verse 6, and it says, "Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection; on such the second death shall hath no power, but they shall be priests of Elohim in the and of Messiah, and shall reign with him for 1,000 years." Okay, so the second resurrection, that particular thing doesn't happen, at least not in the King James Version of the Bible. You get the two words used in the same sentence or in the same verse, but it's not a thing. You get the first resurrection, which would imply that there's a second resurrection. Okay, but it doesn't actually say that anywhere in the Scripture. Just to let you know. Now, Azamra has this on verses 12 through 14. Okay, and I'll stop at the end of verse 14. Verses 12 to 13 allegorically depict the destruction of Assyria. This is Azamra on this now. Depict the destruction of Assyria and all those who took refuge in the shadow of this mighty tree, i.e., its allies and tributaries. The purpose of its terrible downfall was to teach mankind Elohim's lesson, so that no one of all the trees of the waters, in other words, of the other nations, should exalt themselves in their height. For they are all delivered to death, to the nether parts of the earth, in the midst of the children of men, with them to go down to the pit, in verse 14. In the words of Metsudas David, for all of them are destined to die and descend to the nether world, in other words, the grave. Since all of them are going to die, what point is there in swelling with arrogance over their great worldly wealth and power? Of course, the hymn in verse 12 and following, I think, refers to the Assyrian, Sennacherib, since the only other third-person masculine singular noun in the passage is Adonaiyah, and he ain't going anywhere. So verse 12 has strangers cutting Nineveh and Assyria off. The strangers are obviously either Babylon or Israel, and since Israel is under the thumb of either Babylon or Assyria, well, it's pretty much a given. So Babylon, under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar, have cut Sennacherib off and left him. Okay, twice the phrase left him is used in this verse. The word that's translated left is the Hebrew 5203, natash, which means to uproot or to tear out. So I assume that Sennacherib died in the battle with Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 13 talks about the birds chowing down on the Assyrian carrion.
All right, so we're going to chow down on the top there, so we'll be right back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something. Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true.
I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more.
there'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
All right, we are back, folks. The second hour now of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh Edition, and Exodus. I'm sorry, I keep saying Exodus because it's EX, but it's EZ, Ezekiel in my notes. Ezekiel chapter 31, and the metaphor of the tree here, and of course the parallels that I think are kind of difficult to deny. A lot of focus on ancient Assyria and some of the kingdoms then, but I can't help but think, and I like to repeat this fairly frequently, not only history, but scripture not only repeats itself, but certainly rhymes in a lot of cases, and there's a lot of rhyming going on here. So anyway, we interrupted MP. Let's go back to him, let him catch up with where he was headed at the break.
All right, thank you. Yeah, I was on verse 12, so let me get back there. The hymn of verse 12, I think, refers to the Assyrian Sennacherib, since the only other third-person masculine singular noun in the passage is Adonaiyah, and he ain't going anywhere. I was actually through there. Anyway, verse 12 has strangers cutting Nineveh, Assyria off. The strangers are obviously either Babylon or Israel. And since Israel is under the thumb of either Babylon or Assyria, well, that's pretty much a given. So Babylon, under the leadership of Nebuchadnezzar, have cut Sennacherib off and left him. Twice the phrase left him is used in this verse. The word that's translated left is the Hebrew 5203 natash, which means to uproot or to tear out. So I assume that Sennacherib died in the battle with Nebuchadnezzar. Not that he died with Nebuchadnezzar, but that Nebuchadnezzar's forces killed him. Now, verse 13 talks about the birds chowing down on the Assyrian carrion. I assume that some Babylonians died in the battle, but the majority of the bird feed is going to be Assyrian on this day. And I assume that the Babylonians would have carried their dead off for burial. Now, verse 13 has the fowls of the air and the scavengers feeding on Sennacherib's and Assyria's dead. Verse 14 gives me the impression that the birds are awaiting what the animals of the fields leave behind, and that it may be a massive feast for the birds, which merely have to wait their turn. They may have eaten enough to not be able to get off the ground for the wait. There will be that much of it there. That's what I have through verse 14, if you'd like to jump in.
Okay, Ken, should we head on, or you want to catch up? Ken?
I would start at verse 15. I don't know if you can't hear me.
Yeah, we hear you.
So works fine.
We read through that already.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You read 15? Let me just comment on 15. I just have a small note here. So verse 15, I believe, is a beautiful depiction of Yah's love for even the Assyrians with mourning and respect for the dead. He calmed all the nations just so that this time of mourning could be felt for all. And this, I think this truly does show the love that Yah exudes upon all men of the earth, even those that fall into wickedness. And, you know, to me, it's this is kind of proof positive. It's not like Yah loves the good and he hates those who sin. I mean, yes, he hates the sin, but I don't believe at all that he hates the individual. Now, if I believe that if they're born into it, like what we saw in the land, remember, from the fallen angels and the mixing with the seed of man, it is hard to say what those beings were and what they were like, because we weren't there. Now, I know there's a lot of speculation about that, but to me, I think that was mixing things like DNA, you know, messing with DNA, kind of like what they're doing
yeah,
today.
Kind of like today.
Which, again, is probably, yeah, it's kind of like why you see those words even in the Brit Hadashah that, and the New Testament that says that, as in the days of Noah, because that's what was going on in that day, and we see it today too. And there's no doubt that when we're being injected with mRNA, that there's a lot of other stuff that's in that jab, by the way.
Oh yeah, that's the least of it.
For real.
Yeah, for real. Yeah, and from what I hear, and there's been, so-called proof of this, is that, there's many snake venoms also. Different types of poisonous snake venoms that are in this jab as well. And well, I believe
whether,
all that's gonna be coming
true,
out. I mean, it has come out, but, to the masses, I'm not so sure. You know,
whether
go ahead,
not,
MC.
Whether or not that is true, there are certainly lots of other things that are in there, like various nanotechnology and chemical processes that mimic biological processes. It's a veritable witch's brew. I think that's a good way to put it. A pharmacopoeia extraordinaire of stuff that has been engineered to cause, well, trans.
Especially.
Go ahead. Especially.
Yeah, especially when you hear about what's pulled out of their veins after they're dead, okay? I mean,
well, yeah.
they talk about so-called clots, but the material of the so-called clot is not what you would normally see in a real blood clot. It is something that is kind of made and fabricated from other materials that are not normally found in the human body. So to me, that's yeah, it's got to be coming from that jab, I believe. In any case,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. That jab is one of the wickedest things that ever has been foisted upon humanity.
I really think it's going to match the words that we read about in the book of Revelation. We just don't know all the numbers yet of today that.
Absolutely.
You know, the amount of those that have died.
As a matter of fact, I think it's a lead in to the book of Revelation.
Yeah, it very well could be.
I mean, physical manifestation of the book of Revelation, we're going to go into it, and this thing is starting the whole thing.
Okay. But anyway.
Oh.
We're kind of reaching into this and that now, aren't we?
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, let's get back
anyway,
to the priest
just,
here.
And in terms of verse... No, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to take us back to the trees and the topic.
The trees. Yes, and the trees were, it says, I covered the deep for him and restrained the floods thereof. If you're looking at verse 15, the great waters were stayed. Boy, you can't help but think of those words and think about back in the Torah when they were about to cross the Red Sea. I mean, doesn't that match that to a T there? it's kind of weird, how he put these words right in the midst of this. But anyway, I think it's just another cycle. It's a cycle of the wicked being washed away by his hand, you know, because remember, he reaches out and makes a change in the earth. And when he does, this is what happens. Many die. Many are brought to the grave, it says. We see the word grave here in verse 15. It's funny. You see the word grave there, and didn't we see the word hell somewhere else?
Yeah,
and of course,
verses 15 and 16 both.
Christianity is going to see that differently. 15 and 16. Wait a minute. Am I seeing hell in? Oh yeah, there it is. You're right.
Sheol,
verse
twice.
16. You see the word hell. Yep. You see the word grave in 15, but both of which are the word Sheol. And this right. is how the mind gets twisted a little bit. You know, this is how we come up with maybe agendas. I hate to say it, but back in the days of the translators, there could have been agendas in that day as well. There are agendas today.
Absolutely.
We know it.
Honestly, this
it's
is something
the way
that,
of man.
Yep. This is something yours truly has talked about a lot. The agenda for the King James, the authorized version, was very clear. It was, among other things, to promote the divine right of kings and to basically say, hey, whatever, the king's word is law. Forget that God of the Bible. The king is his appointed emissary. When he says jump, you say how high. And if that sounds like something you've read in the government-inspired version for Romans 13 and other places, it's because there is a consistent pattern here. And I guess you could say there ain't nothing new under the sun.
Right. Right.
All right.
That's right.
That's
exactly.
Right.
So,
our cycles.
Other comments, or should we read on? We're almost at the end.
We can read on.
We're almost at the end of the chapter here anyway.
Hey, may as well read to the end.
Yep. So it says this in verse 17 through the end of 31. They also went down to, there it is again, Sheol with it, with those slain by the sword, and those who were its strong arm dwelt in its shadows among the mountains. Now, a couple of words there in italics, so I'll read it without the words in italics. They also went down to Sheol with it, and those by the sword. And I think slain isn't necessarily too bad. That makes the sense there. And those, its strong arm dwelt in its shadows among the nations. And there are references that I can't help but think to a place where you see, those who trust in the arm of flesh, they're in a whole heap of trouble. To those which of the trees, to which of the trees in Eden will you then be likened in glory and greatness? Yes, yet you shall be brought down with the trees of Eden to the depths of the earth. You shall lie in the midst of the uncircumcised with those slain by the sword. This is Pharaoh and all his multitude, says Yahuwah Eloheka. So again, at the end of the prophecy, he tells us for the beginning and ending time that, yeah, we're talking about Pharaoh here. And remember, what was it that characterized Pharaoh? Not only is he a king, but a little bit like some of those that to translate the Bible according to their own exalted position, he was a god among men as far as he was concerned. All right, who wants it? Go ahead, MP.
All right, let me finish up here. Verse 13 has the fowls of the air and the scavengers feeding on Sennacherib's and Assyria's dead bodies. And verse 14 gives me the impression that the birds are awaiting what the animals of the fields leave behind, and that it may be a massive feast for the birds, which merely have to wait their turn. They may have eaten enough to not be able to get off the ground for the wait. Now, verse 15 gives me the impression that Yah wasn't exactly pleased with Assyria, that Assyria had been defeated, but knew that it would be the natural flow of things. One nation succeeds for a time, only to be overcome by another. I fear that that's just the way it is, and that's the way it's going to happen very shortly in our day, with the United States is going to go down. I hate to say it. I love the country, and I love the fact of our Constitution and all of that. But
it was cool while
we have gotten so wicked. The nation has gotten so wicked that it really deserves to go. Okay, were you going to say something?
No, I did. I just said it was cool while it lasted. That Constitution thing.
Oh yeah. It's a wonderful document. It really and truly is. Those guys were really after Yah's heart. They were, and they created a nation that was after his heart. And never mind. I'm not gonna go there. Anyway.
Okay.
Azamra's talks on verse 16. They say, I made the nations shake at the sound of his fall, with those that descended into the pit, and all the trees of Eden, the choice and the best of Lebanon, all that drink water were comforted in the nether parts of the world. Now, everything in this world reflects and alludes to the upper worlds, and thus the various nations of this world and their guardian angels correspond to the trees, quote unquote, in the supernal Garden of Eden, and are called this in the verse, in keeping with the allegory of Asher as the mighty cedar. That's Assyria, Asher. The fall of this great tree and the descent of Assyria into hell was a comfort to the other wealthy and mighty who had already died and were in the graves when they saw that even the mighty Assyria finally met with the same fate. For it is a way of a person who sees the same trouble that befell him strike even those greater than himself to feel comforted. And that's according to Metzudas David on chapter on verse 16. Now, Azamra has this on verse 18. The moral of the allegory about the fall of Assyria was directed against Paro, who was to be defeated by Nebuchadnezzar 8 years after his prophecy, but who apparently still believed he was invincible. To whom do you think you compare in glory and greatness among the trees of Eden? In verse 18, Paro and his multitude would suffer the same fate as all other proud and mighty powers of this world and end up in the pit among the slain uncircumcised nations. And that's what's going to happen to this nation eventually. It's going to have to, because this nation has not followed after its godly beginning. It truly hasn't. It hasn't kept up, you know, staying with Yah. It's gone completely the other way. And when you end up watching a various presidents replace each other, and you get to the point where even Trump is good by comparison, there's something wrong with this nation. And we deserve what we get. Anyway, that's what I got for this whole chapter.
All right, Ken?
Yeah, verse, let's see, 16, when it, you know, speaks about the shaking at the sound of his fall. I believe the nations are made to shake at this destruction of a nation, that of Assyria. But I believe this is Yah expounding upon the event so that all know that it was Yah who had performed this upon the earth. And of course, those walking in wickedness will be disturbed. Whereas those walking in the ways of Yah will be comforted through the event. Now,
true.
This would be his ways of judgment and how there is separation between good and evil. But also, when you see these words like nether parts of the earth, sometimes I wonder if that's really not speaking of and including the grave, you know? Because when we're put into the grave, like I said, Enoch actually does detail this, where there is comfort for some and there is not comfort for others. So, and it is talking about, at the beginning of the verse, those who are cast down into the grave. Okay? And there are some trees of Eden, apparently, to go with. And, but then it says all the drink water. Now, drink water is probably, alluding to, you know, Yah's, watering from the heavens. I would think, in order to show the separation, those who drink water, for purposes of, you know, cleansing themselves, and using water, in that way as well. But still, I believe even those who are brought to the grave, like I said, some are comforted, some are not. And depending on, where you were in your life, you know, it's like, and yeah, does Yah know you? Yes, he does know you. And, I believe that's why, you are placed on a certain side of that level of the heavens, which here could be the nether parts of the earth as well. Okay. Because, you know, he even continues in the very next verse, 17. They also went down into hell with him, et cetera, et cetera. Now, those that walked with the Assyrians in the past, I believe that's what they're speaking of in terms of other nations, you know, those that are in under the shadow or in the shadow of a nation would be those who walk, you know, the same, or who follow, who maybe assist, such as in past wars, etc. Those who partook in the sin of the Assyrians. I believe that's who he's speaking of in verse 17. And there's no special place for any particular tribe or nation. Yah just brings all that are good together and those that are wicked to the grave when one dies, right? Whether you're good or whether you're evil, it still speaks about the grave. The one place.
Right.
Sorry. It's That's not right. really, yeah, you don't see that you're brought to heaven or you're brought to hell. You really don't. It's just to the grave, and that word is the word for hell in terms of what the translators translated as. Yeah, it's still Sheol. This is, again, detailed in Enoch, too. And by the way, there are many copies of Enoch found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. To me, that is yet more proof that Enoch is valued as scripture. Okay. And from the very beginning, the dead would go to particular parts of the heavens, according to Enoch and thereafter. Those of uncircumcised heart would, most assuredly lie as slain amongst those of the dead. You know, again, it all kind of correlates, you know. So anyway, that's what I have up to. But now I'm a little confused about what you two mentioned when speaking of Pharaoh here at the end. Now, to me, we were speaking of the Assyrians all throughout the chapter, right up to the end of verse 18 even.
Well,
but I think it's just that that last verse might be talking about how they're all put in the midst together.
No, actually, Ken, remember in chapter 31, right off the top, first couple of verses, it says, "Now it came to pass in the 11th year, in the third month, first day of the month, the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying, Son of man, say to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his multitude." So we start out
That's right.
with that, and we end with that.
Right, meaning we're speaking to the Mitzvites, right?
Well, to Pharaoh
and we're comparing them, yeah, okay, to the Pharaoh and to his multitude, it says. So to me, that's and the Mitzvites. But anyway, and you're speaking about the Assyrians, and I believe it's speaking about the Assyrians all the way through to the end, in terms of them being slaughtered, them being trees, actually. This great tree, brought all the way down to the end here, and that they, being the Assyrians, shall lie in the midst of the uncircumcised. Then it says this, Pharaoh and all the multitude. Now, so that's what I wonder. This word, let's see, this word, this is the word, yeah, he, which, yeah, often is rendered as this or these.
The way that the other nations that conquered Israel came along was first Egypt took them, okay. Then they were followed by Assyria.
All right, we're at the break. We'll pick it up at the synopsis right at the
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for reasons. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come on, come on, down, doobie doo, down, down. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that line by the Lord. The 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not
all right, we are back, folks. Last segment for today. We have basically finished chapter 31. I asked during the break. I'll accept the silence as an indication that MP was finished. But we're ready to read into chapter 32 at this point, which says, "And it came to pass in the 12th year, in the 12th month, on the first day of the month, that the word of Yahuwah came to me, saying," here we go, "Son of man, take up a lamentation for Pharaoh, king of Egypt." So that's who we're talking to, or at least about in this case. "And say to him, you're like a young lion among the Goyim, the nations. You're like a monster in the seas, bursting forth in your rivers, troubling the waters with your feet, and fouling their rivers." Now, we remember that we've talked about this before. There seems to be an allegory associated with the crocodile here, and that certainly looks like another picture in that sense. "So thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, I will therefore spread my net over you with a company of many people, and they will draw you up in my net. Then I will leave you on the land. I'll cast you out on the open fields, and cause to settle on you all the birds of the heavens, and with you will I fill the beasts of the whole earth. I will lay your flesh on the mountains, and fill the valleys with your carcass. I'll also water the land with the flow of your blood, even to the mountains, and the riverbeds will be full of you. When I put out your light, I'll cover the heavens and make its stars dark. I'll cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens will I make dark over you, and bring darkness upon your land, says Yahuwah Eloheka." Now, this is quite a bit of text, but it's consistent, so I'll read just a bit further, then we'll pause here. "And I'll also trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring your destruction among the nations into the countries which you have not known. Yes, I will make many peoples astonished at you, and their king shall be horribly afraid of you when I brandish my sword before them, and they shall tremble every moment, every man for his own life, in the day of your fall. For thus says Yahuwah Eloheka, the sword of the king of Babylon shall come upon you. By the swords of the mighty warriors, all of them, the most terrible of all the nations, I will cause your multitude shall to fall." And I guess we can go ahead and finish this section here. MP wanted to read through 16, so here we go.
Go to verse 16.
"They shall plunder the pomp of Egypt, and all its multitudes shall be destroyed. Also will I destroy all its animals from beside the great waters. The foot of man shall muddy them no more, nor shall the hooves of animals muddy them. Then I will make their waters clear, and make their rivers run like oil, says Yahuwah Eloheka. When I make the land of Egypt desolate, and the country is destitute of all that once filled it, when I strike all who dwell in it, then they shall know." Here it is. We haven't seen this yet today, but he keeps saying this because it must be important. "Then they shall know, ki ani Yahuwah. This is the lamentation which they shall lament her. The daughters of the nations shall lament her. They shall lament for her, for Mitzrayim, and for all her multitude, says Yahuwah Eloheka." So, MP, let's go to you. You were the one that wanted me to read that far. Let's talk about it. What do you think?
All right. We're probably not going to get finished commenting on that today, but we'll get started here. The two prophecies.
When it get real big, you have to dig them up and, okay, and at least order that.
Got it.
Now so that.
Yeah.
The two prophecies in verses 1 through 16 and then in 17 through 32 of this chapter, received by Ezekiel in Babylon in the 12th year, in the 12th month. In other words, in the month of Adar of the year following the destruction of the temple, on the 1st and 15th of the month, respectively. We see that days like Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, and the 15th of Adar, which was later to become the feast of Shushan Purim, are particularly auspicious for spiritual ascent and prophecy. The message of these prophecies is directed against Paro, king of Egypt. You thought yourself to be a lion among the nations, but you are like a crocodile in the waters, in verse 2. You imagined that in relation to the other nations, you are like a lion against a flock of sheep. But it is not so. Dry land is not so because you are like a crocodile in the waters who has no strength except in his own place in the waters. But the moment he comes into the dry land, he dies. Likewise, you have power only in your own land. That's according to Metzudat David, okay? In other words, had Paro been content with a policy of isolationism without trying to interfere in international affairs, he could have survived. But because he sought to wield influence throughout the world, sounds a little like the Ukraine right now, doesn't it? Anyway, as when Paro Necho campaigned in the time of King Josiah to try to contain Assyria, and when Paro in Zedekiah's time tried to campaign against Nebuchadnezzar, he came to grief. Similarly, many Americans today are coming to the conclusion that their country would be more successful if it sought to play less of a role internationally, and that its role as global policeman is endangering its very survival. I'm going to stop there with verse 2. This is really important to me. Okay. We are sticking our noses into too many people's business. Okay. The United States of America. And we ought not to be dealing with that SOB in the Ukraine at all. My own personal opinion, I could be wrong, but I doubt it.
There's a line that I remember from a movie that I really liked, MP, called Serenity. And the line goes like this, we meddle. And people don't like that. And I think that's pretty apropos. We meddle. We meddle a lot.
Exactly. We meddle. We meddle a lot. And it's really none of our business. We ought to be worried about us, okay? And those people that we get along with and we can do business with, and those people that we don't get along with, let them die. I don't care, you know? I really don't. Anyway, on we go.
Okay.
I've commented through verse 3.
Okay, let me start in verses 1 and 2 here. So this chapter starts, what, a year and 9 months after the previous chapter?
Right about.
In which Mitzrayim was made to remember Assyria, their neighbor. But at this time, Yah desires lamentation from Ezekiel for the Pharaoh,
yep,
who has troubled and influenced others with his walk. Okay, metaphoric for his feet. The waters are a place for people to receive life-saving fluids for one's body, and thus such an overtaking of such would have great influence. The Pharaoh's walk apparently caused the fouling of the growth of those seeking the waters of life. And thus this greatly offends Yah in that others are influenced in a bad way to where there is no hope for any to learn of the ways of Yah. And it's funny that we kind of see that today going on, the same thing going on. We're changing what's being taught in schools. We're changing what is acceptable, you know, we now accept wickedness. We're making legal things that are sinful that we never would have made legal in the past.
Oh, it goes beyond that.
It's just amazing.
I like to put it this
yes.
way. They not only teach that which is wrong and abomination in Scripture and say that it's okay, they teach that you better do it or we'll take your kids away. And literally, and they're going to subsidize
right.
it. If it's abortion, if it's an abomination, if it's killing, if it's you name it, anything that is a perversion, they are going to not only subsidize it, but teach it and then mandate it. And we're at the place where, I guess you could put it this way, Ken, they're calling evil good and good evil.
Absolutely. Exactly.
Absolutely correct.
That's where we are. Yeah. But yeah, I just wanted to make that kind of connection that, you know, even like into this day or that day back then, we're seeing the same thing going on here too.
Yep.
that it just feels like there's just no hope for Yah's ways to grow, you know, amongst our communities, the way that sin is sitting hold in so many different aspects of our lives now. It's just incredible. Now, where did I see this? I saw the word in my translation, which is the King James. I saw the word wail, trying to figure out where that was.
As in cry and wail.
In verse 2, it says, as a whale in the seas.
Oh.
And it is interesting. That word whale is really, hold on 1 second. It's Strong's number 8577, which is Tanim, which usually is rendered as dragon or serpent. Okay? And I really think that dragon or serpent would be a better translation in this place in scripture, because that's exactly what Pharaoh was. He was acting as a great serpent. And he did, live amongst these rivers, this great river. So when it says that he, this serpent, really, serpent or dragon, that he troubles the waters with thy feet. To me, that's really saying that he's disturbing, you know, the ways of us or of the people of that day receiving what they needed for life, for a good life, you know. So he's troubling the water and fouling, it says, the rivers, which feeds them the water. Okay. So he's fouling the rivers, which means the water is becoming fouled. And again, that's just like what's going on today. You know, everything is being fouled. It's hard to get good word anymore half the time. Even when you turn on the news, you're literally listening to lies and deceit. No more is there truth. And respect.
Absolutely.
And, you know, things that, you know, we should care about. It's just amazing what kind of filth you listen to and you see when you turn on that box that's, you know, hanging in your house. It's just a shame. But anyway,
it's largely due to the crime family too.
Sure. But the crime family, I think in this case being the super, super rich, you know, the elitists of the world. I think they have gotten together, you know, met together behind the scenes for years and have planned this event.
Oh, that's absolutely the truth. People like Soros and Bill Gates and people like that, absolutely. Absolutely. But in the political arena, we're talking about the Republican and Democrat parties, both of them. There are good people in both, but most of the people in those parties are absolutely wicked.
You know what they say? Yeah. It's the 97% that give the good ones a bad name.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's true. But hopefully there'll always be a remnant, right? We can only have
exactly.
Have a hope.
And that's what we've got. I mean, in the Senate, we got like Rand Paul, and I can't think of a whole lot of others.
Yeah, there's only a few. There really is.
Seriously,
not too many.
And it used to be that his dad was in the House, you know, and he was a good guy. There just aren't very many actual Americans in Congress or in any other place in the government. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, in the state house, in the local. Local city arenas. There just are not good constitutionalist Americans.
Yeah, okay? true.
If you live by that Constitution, you're living the way you ought to be living. Okay?
That's right. I would agree.
It's absolutely biblical.
Yep.
Anyway.
Anyway, let me comment on verses 3 through 6. Now, We should note here that Yah is likening the Mitzrites in these verses to fish, which he's catching with a net and throwing upon the land, upon an open field to be consumed by all the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the earth. And Yah goes on to lay more of their flesh on the mountains and valleys in great numbers. I believe Yah is giving the listeners in that day and the readers in this day and previously and in the future a picture of a really great death with bodies laid in many places, exuding blood as a covering of the land. And the blood appears to even fill the rivers as well, which I believe, and I've already heard a little bit of this, brings us back thematically to what Yah wanted to show the Mitzrites in the days of Moshe. I think I heard MP mention this. Only
you were absolutely right. I got a whole book about it.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So. Yeah, maybe those back in that day, that was kind of a little hint for them, you know? This is just yet another cycle of the wickedness. But yeah, without water to drink and nothing but blood remaining, and now I'm speaking of that first plague, by the way, okay,
yeah.
If you remember, consider... Absolutely. Consider that without water to drink and nothing but blood remaining, that all would have died if Yah had not removed the blood from the waters. And, yep. And we may recall last chapter, it's funny there, where the penalty seemed quite similar with the Assyrians, only they were detailed as a tree. You know, vice we see here that the Mitzrites are likened to fish. So, again, you know, Yah likens us to different things at times. I also consider myself and many others who I know, even those that I love, we're all asses. Yes, we're all literally asses because that is the one. Now, yes, you could also use the word donkey. I think both of the
donkey is a female
meaning. Wait a minute, which one's the female?
The ass is the female donkey.
The ass is the female. Okay. So, and I believe the ass was the only animal that could be redeemed with a lamb. Is that not correct?
That I can't say for
sure.
In
the Torah?
I don't recall.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the only unclean animal that literally it said I'd have to go back and look it up, but I do remember this. Very vividly. Yes, this is the one animal that can be redeemed by a lamb. And boy, if that's not really a picture of us, okay? Because that's probably a good name for all of us.
Oh boy.
Especially at certain times. No, go ahead, MP. What was that?
I'm agreeing with you. Oh boy. Yeah. That's
right.
It's absolutely the truth, because if there's anybody out there that's an ass, it's me. Okay. And I'm proud
of that a lot too. I hate to say it, but yeah. In my house, being my wife, I'm called that a lot. Oh. I think she's yelling at me again. I might be hearing that word again. But anyway. I think that's what I wanted to kind of stop with here. I'll go ahead and give MP a chance to catch up to verse 6. How's that?
All right, I'll see what I can do. I can get us up to kind of verse 7. Okay. The message of these prophecies is directed against Paro, king of Egypt, okay? You thought yourself to be a lion among the nations, but you are like a crocodile in the waters, is what it says in verse 2. You imagined that in relation to the other nations, you are like a lion against a flock of sheep. But it's not right. That's not right. dry land, he dies, okay? Because you are a crocodile in the waters, there's no strength except in your own place in the waters. But the moment he comes up onto the land, he dies, or is more likely to. Likewise, you have power only in your own land. That's, again, Metzudas David is talking. In other words, had Paro been content with a policy of isolationism without trying to interfere in international affairs, he could have survived. But because he sought to wield influence throughout the world, as when Paro Necho campaigned in the time of King Josiah to try to contain Assyria, and when Paro in Zedekiah's time tried to campaign against Nebuchadnezzar, they came to grief. Similarly, many Americans today are coming to the conclusion that their country would be more successful if it sought to play less of a role internationally, and that its role as global policeman is endangering its very survival. And ain't that the truth? The stuff that we're doing with Ukraine, and we're literally fomenting a nuclear war with Russia, who is going to have help from China, okay? Three biggest nuclear powers in the world we're talking about, okay? This is a bad idea. We ought not to be involved with Zelensky and the Ukraine at all, okay? Bad, bad idea. Anyway, verses 3 and following depict the coming fall of Egypt. And when I extinguish you, Yah says, I will cover the heaven and make its stars dark. That's in verse 7. All who hear what has befallen you will mourn and be astonished, for each one will be fearful for himself, saying that the destroyer will also succeed against us. Again, according to Rashi, that's what he has to say. I'm talking up to verse 5. So, anything else? How much time we got left? About a minute.
Yeah, less than a minute.
I just want to say too that I'm in total agreement with what MP's been saying about how our nation feels about us being at so-called war with Russia over there in Ukraine. Okay. I think most people here do not want such a war. I believe most citizens of the country of Ukraine do not want war. Actually, I feel probably a good portion of them in Ukraine have always thought of themselves as Russians. They were a part of Russia from, hundreds of years
back. Part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Never mind. Go ahead.
I think I've actually seen footage, even with polls, taken by reputable pollers in Russia, that Putin is like way more than 80% favored by his citizens in what he's doing. And I mean, he often speaks before them, by the way, letting them know about the wickedness going on in this earth. And I kind of agree with him. There's a lot of wickedness going on.
Well, that'll take us out for today. So we'll pick it up. Finish chapter 32 next time. Thanks, guys.